Welcome back to Under the Radar here on Radio Islam International this Sunday evening. And we at the moment talk about the recent death of Eliyahu David Kay, who was a South African who emigrated from Johannesburg to Israel and thereafter gained Israeli citizenship and for a while joined the Israeli army. He was killed during a gunfire with Palestinians near the Bab al-Silsila, or the chain gate, one of the gates of Masjid al-Aqsa. That's obviously the old city of occupied East Jerusalem, illegally occupied, and that's a fact recognized by South Africa, the United Nations, and the virtual majority of world's governments to be the capital of Palestine. This obviously has set up a lot of discussion. On the one hand, you have family and the community from which Eliyahu David Kay comes in South Africa, expressing anger, mourning his loss and so forth. And on the other hand, many voices for justice in South Africa asking the wider questions about South Africans serving in the Israeli army. Let's go through some of these this evening with Zinat Adam. She is the Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center. Zinat, shukran for your time. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jazakallah khair for having me on air.
So let's go through a number of issues here. First, I want to look at the nature of this incident, because what we know about Eliyahu David Kay in this instance particularly is that he served in the Israeli army, perhaps for his official service was from around 2017 to 2019. And I've even seen, you know, some international human rights advocates saying that, you know, there can be no other argument in this particular case. At the time that he was killed, he was a civilian. And you know, just like civilians are killed, you know, in different parts of this injustice, this should also be seen in that particular light. Is it possible to be making a differentiation of a person being a civilian when they had served in the Israeli army and in that sense are considered part of its reserve force?
Well, to start off with, Ibrahim, yes, he had been enlisted in the IDF, and at the time of his death, he was no longer serving physically in the IDF. What he was a reservist, because even if you are inactive in the IDF, you are still considered a reservist. And the work that he was conducting, including on the day of his death, was supposedly as a tour guide, but this is within the ambit of the Israeli security network. This is the kind of work that he was doing. Now, the questions that arise on our side is, of course, we regret any deaths that happen anywhere in the world. These are human beings, and we regret all of this. But we need to understand the context within which this incident took place. If we look at the last few months, we've seen an escalation of tensions in Al-Quds, and particularly around the area of Sheikh Jarrah. We've seen the appropriation of land. We've seen the demolition of homes. We've seen the desecration of cemeteries and landmarks around Al-Haram Al-Quds. This is the sanctuary and the centrality of Palestine is Jerusalem. And this is exactly where the incident took place and where Eliyahu David Kay lost his life. But in understanding that, we need to recognize that anyone who serves in the IDF is a combatant, even when they are active as a reservist, not active within the IDF, but as a reservist. They're still combatants in the space, and they are still effectively acting on behalf of the settler occupation within the Palestinian territories. So this is the recognition that we are asking for and saying that justice needs to, and human rights needs to be acknowledged within the wider scope when we're looking at this case.
Now, the idea then that is often communicated, you know, with reference to relevant pieces of international law and so forth, that people who are occupied have a right to resist. We obviously hear people say that. But at the same time, for instance, you know, human rights organizations would, in cases such as the aggression on Gaza, sometimes point to Israeli violations of international law, and you know, side by side, speak about the actions of Palestinian armed groups or Palestinian resistance groups. And also there's a kind of hesitance, when Palestinians embark on certain types of resistance to occupation that's, you know, more widely accepted, and certain types are frowned upon, or, you know, there's not so much an enthusiastic response to it, or people are a bit hesitant to talk about it. Even people who are supporters of the Palestinian cause. So how do we square that circle of what international law says versus when Palestinians embark on these actions, the reaction to it?
I think that, you know, we can theorize about these issues, and we can sit outside of the space in which the occupation is taking place, and we can cast our own opinions about how resistance should actually be effected. But to be honest, none of us are actually on those front lines where children are being arrested, harassed, terrorized on a daily basis, where cemeteries are being desecrated, where people who have been imprisoned are still being held in prison even after they have passed away. The kind of brutality that this occupation has had on the Palestinian people for decades, for 70 odd years, is unbearable. And if we are to say, well, this is the type of resistance you should be having, and that's the type of resistance you shouldn't, we're actually not empowering the Palestinians to be able to take their own decisions. And we're not recognizing the kind of pressure that they're living under, and the constant bombardment that comes in from the Israelis, the constant terrorizing that happens from the IDF, and from people like Eliyahu David Kay, who is now, you know, being hailed as a hero in many spaces and being said that he was a lone soldier, etc. But this is a systematic approach of recruiting people from South Africa and from other parts of the world, enlisting them into the IDF, making them those soldiers and those tools of occupation. So without Eliyahu David Kay going to Israel, claiming to be wanting to have dual citizenship, wanting to be enlisted in the IDF, you would not have the strength of the occupation that we're currently seeing. And then on the other side of it, Ibrahim, is if we look at the kind of moves that are being made in the West in particular, and more recently in Britain, to cast Hamas, not just its military wing, but including its political bureau, as completely recognized as a terrorist organization, it completely defeats the purpose of us trying to find peace in occupied Palestine and trying to find a reasonable solution to this. Because if we do not have a situation where all parties can be recognized and can be talked to, then you're not going to be able to find a just and lasting solution to the situation in the Palestinian territories.
You mentioned the idea or the status quo of South Africans who have served in the Israeli army having dual citizenship. Now, I'm not sure if it's absolutely clear whether Eliyahu Kay had dual citizenship or not. But in the broader sense, all right, we've just seemed to have lost Zenith there for just prior to that question. Just piecing about the story, which I think is of very critical importance. On the one hand, some very notable stances by the South African government, but in this case, obviously we'd be able to point to serious lapse by the South African government in terms of, seeing through some of these laws. Zenit, I understand you're back with us. I just was exploring the idea of dual citizenship. We're not sure if it was something that was applicable in this case, but broadly speaking, what are the laws in South Africa that speak to this issue of South Africans serving in military conflicts overseas, and what has been the state of application of those laws in South Africa since those laws have been mandated?
So there's a few things, Ibrahim. If we talk about the issue of dual citizenship, it's a very interesting issue that South Africa grappled with when we gained our freedom as to whether or not South Africa would allow for that. So dual citizenship in South Africa is accepted and is allowed, provided that the other country that you're applying for would also be accepting of dual citizenship. And in the case of the State of Israel, it has been accepted. And in fact, there have been numerous South African Israeli dual citizenship holders who have enlisted in the IDF. And this has been through active recruitment by the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, by the Jewish National Fund, by the Zionist Federation, and other organizations that work towards trying to recruit people from South Africa and elsewhere. So yes, they do hold dual citizenship. And based on this, these organizations have been arguing that it would be an impediment to their freedoms as South African citizens if the South African laws would withdraw any dual citizenship. Now, this is something that has been debated in Parliament a couple of times. It hasn't yet reached a point where it has been put into any act or that there is going to be any legislation as yet. And, of course, this would be much broader than the Israeli situation, but this is a very important case in point. We could also consider and discuss the enlisting of South African dual citizens in the British Royal Navy or in the British Army. We could look at those who have been enlisted in private military security firms, which has a very, very different legislation that would conduct over that as well. But there have been South Africans that have served in the British Army, there have been South Africans that have served in the American forces, and in other forces as well. These have acted, perhaps, for example, we could look at the situation in Iraq. And again, we haven't highlighted what kind of brutalities South Africans have perpetrated in these spaces. But when we're talking about Israel in particular, what really concerned me as an activist and as an academic is that it would appear that we are effectively exporting apartheid. Because if we are saying, as the South African government, we recognize that Israel is an apartheid state, we recognize that the activities of the settler colonial state is reminiscent of the apartheid that we experienced and that Palestinians are being subjugated to that, then why are we accepting that South African citizens or dual citizenship holders would have the freedom to enlist in the Israeli Defense Force, which is an apartheid defense force, in my opinion, it's not really a defense force, but it's actually one of occupation. How are we accepting of this in terms of our own history, in terms of our own laws, and in terms of our own freedoms? What we're effectively doing is saying, we don't mind if you have apartheid elsewhere in the world, you can take our citizens and let them perpetrate the apartheid anywhere else. And this is not just so for Israel. We've had complaints from people around the world that human rights have been violated, where South Africans have enlisted as either mercenaries or in private military security firms or for other government defense forces, where they have actually been quite brutal. Case in point would be, for example, Libya. We've had some complaints about South Africans who had been active there. We know that South Africans active in Mozambique have also been very brutal to the civilians there. So there have been other laws that have been tried to be put in place For example, one that we know of is the Regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act. This was introduced in 1996, and then it was actually gazetted by 1998. Really not much happened through this law and through this act. When people had gone abroad and performed mercenary activities or worked in a foreign military, they were not persecuted when they returned. And if there were any cases like that, these were settled out of court, and it was for a minimal fine of something like 3,000 rand. It really, really didn't have any major effect. This law is still in effect, and we can use that, but there was another law that was proposed and another act that was proposed after South Africans had performed mercenary activities in Equatorial Guinea in 2006. So what had taken place is this was to try and prevent mercenary activity. And this law hasn't been completely gazetted. It's called the Prohibition of Mercenary Activities and Regulation of Certain Activities in Countries of Armed Conflict. Through this, any person who wants to, somebody like Eliyahu David Kay, who wants to enlist in a foreign military, would have to seek permission from the South African government, from the NCACC and from the Minister of Defense, to have permission to be able to do this, and failing which, it would be considered mercenary activity, or it would be considered in violation of both of these acts, the Regulation of Foreign Military Assistance and the prohibition of mercenary activities. This is not happening. We're not finding means to be able to actually prosecute these people in a court of law. And there is absolute hesitancy on the part of our national prosecuting authority and on the part of the police services to even investigate when these kind of cases have been brought to their attention.
Which brings me to the question of, another precedent in this regard, or information that was put forward to the South African authorities, the so-called Gaza docket from the period of 2009 onwards. We know that it speaks to, or I know that it speaks to, this issue of South Africans enlisting and in the Israeli army. What was the smoking gun proof, if you'd like, that was contained in that particular dossier, and in the broader spirit of what you've been speaking about, the failure to enforce these laws, what have we learned, or what can be learned through that experience of why it has not been successful, and perhaps alternative strategies to make sure that this smoking gun evidence actually results in investigations and prosecutions?
So the Gaza docket was quite an interesting docket that was put together by the Muslim Lawyers Association and the Media Review Network and other organizations. It consisted of about more than 3,000 pages of evidence that they were able to bring forward, and also had a list of approximately 73 to 75 South Africans who were believed to have been serving in the IDF at that point of Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. There was evidence put forward that some of them were at very high-ranking positions, including a person, Lieutenant Colonel David Benjamin. And in fact, he came to South Africa. Now, it was known that he had been advising the IDF on Operation Cast Lead, and that there were several war crimes that had taken place during this time, including the use of weapons such as white phosphorus and others, including the deliberate targeting of people, civilians, of buildings in which people were housed. And these are considered war crimes in any international law. Unfortunately, there did not seem to be any interest on the part of the NPA and the SAPS to investigate, and this didn't really move very much further. I think this is about political will. It's about the kind of pressure that the Zionist lobby has on our government. And then there was an interest by the ICC to investigate it, by Ocampo, But even that hasn't really moved in the direction that we would have liked to see it. I think that ultimately what we need to do is to continue applying this kind of pressure and asking these kind of questions, because essentially what we're seeing is deep hypocrisy in the West and schizophrenia in South Africa's policies.
And that's the last point I want to focus on, schizophrenia in South Africa's policies, because, you know, it comes on the back of, you know, undeniable strides that South Africa has made. I mean, South Africa, you mentioned earlier, for instance, outlawing of Hamas that's taking place in Europe and so forth. The South African government previously hosted Hamas without any, not bowing into pressure from particular interest groups, and you know, they navigated that with much confidence. Recently, the statement regarding the Miss South Africa controversy from the South African government, as well as the ruling party, I thought was quite forthright and, you know, didn't pull any punches. But then, you have this letter that has come out from the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, addressed to the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, dated the 25th of November, where the South African government says it's deeply saddened by the death of Mr. LAOK, sending condolences, and also condemning the actions which led to his death, and calling both Palestinians and Israelis to exercise restraint until peace finally reigns, and so forth. And on the back of that, you have the South African government also now going to be commemorating the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinians, and you have the Deputy Minister of International Relations perhaps ironically writing on the Daily Maverick that solidarity with the Palestinian people must go beyond slogans, and the United Nations must abide by its resolutions. How do we make sense of all of this?
Well, we'd very much like to see the South African government go beyond the slogans, but effectively what they're doing is telling us that we should be in solidarity with Palestinians, and saying all of the beautiful flowery language that they do in all of their statements at the United Nations and in Geneva, in New York, etc. But on the ground, things are very different. And even though we've had the downgrade of the embassy, the relations between South Africa and Israel have continued very strongly, particularly our trade relations. I think it's in close to 80 billion this year. We have even sold them aircraft, helicopters, and other kinds of equipment this year. So what do you think those things are going to be used for? They may not be equipped with missile technology, but certainly if you have sold a helicopter to Israel, they're not going to be using it for joyrides around Jerusalem. You know, it doesn't make sense from our perspective. The other thing is that we're still continuing deep levels of trade when it comes to agriculture, and more recently on the COVID vaccine, we've opened our country to say that we are happy to be a test place for the new COVID vaccine in a tablet that the Israelis have produced and would like to try out. And apparently South Africans are going to be the guinea pigs for that. Then we have the statement coming from Minister Naledi Pandor, which to me shows that there was intense pressure from the South African Jewish Board of Deputies. Let's think about this very practically. Firstly, this letter is not written to Eliyahu David K's family offering condolences. It's written to a South African Jewish Board of Deputies, which is a Zionist lobby group in South Africa, offering them the condolences. Has this ever happened when any other South African has died anywhere from any other circumstances around the world where an organization is given the condolences? I don't think so. I remember in my term when I was working in government, not even those who were enlisted in our own forces and were deployed abroad were even given that kind of honor. We had people who were deployed in Darfur at the time that I was working on the Horn of Africa. One of them had been kidnapped and had gone through a terrible ordeal. We managed to secure his release. When we got him back to South Africa, not one of the ministers came to the airport to welcome this person back and to thank them for their services. And yet we're writing these beautiful letters to the South African Jewish Board of Deputies. It is absolutely unprecedented. And what it shows is that we're willing to give in when there comes that kind of pressure from an organization like this. What this has actually done is to expose the South African government for its hypocrisy when it comes to the issues of the Palestinians. That on the one hand, we're saying that we are in solidarity with the Palestinians. And on the other hand, while, yes, they have the right to condemn and to condole Eliyahu David Kay's death respectfully to the family, but that's not what this was. This was a very much a political statement. We have seen subsequently the Media Review Network and Africa for Palestine have written to the Minister of Justice and asking that we look, that South Africa looks into the participation of South Africans participating in foreign wars, particularly in the IDF. And this is where the pressure needs to be applied on the South African government, using the laws that we already have, the regulation of foreign military assistance and the prevention of mercenary activities. That's where the pressure needs to be applied, and we need to hold our government to account for its hypocrisy, for its schizophrenic policies, and apply that kind of pressure on them to say that this is not right. You cannot say that this was an innocent civilian who was out there and that he died. He was enlisted in the Israeli Defense Force. It is possible. We do not have the evidence as yet, but it is possible that he was involved in terrorizing the Palestinian children, in targeting people and being a tool for the occupation. And until we recognize that, and until we recognize that this is part of a military-industrial complex that is far bigger than beautiful statements, we will not be able to really make a change in Palestine.
Senator Adam is the Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center, and talking about the case of David Eliyahu Kay and South Africans serving in the Israeli army. I thank you so much for the detailed analysis this evening. Shukran.